720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. I'll be with you for the next hour talking all about business and technology and events and all that good stuff happening right here that affects us here in Chicago. We're going to be talking about the FCC's new battle against robocalls a little bit later. We're going to be talking about the parcel of land everybody's kind of calling the Finkel Project because it's related to where the Finkel Steel facility was. And we're going to be talking about some YouTube advertisers and their woes of having ads on videos they would rather not have them on. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we get to all that, I want to check in with Kiana McKenzie. She is co-chair of M Boutique, which is an event happening right now as we speak here today in Chicago. Welcome to the program, Kiana. Uh-oh, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
There we go. There you are. Well, thanks for taking time out. I'm sure you're running around doing all kinds of things at the event today, but tell us a bit about M Boutique and how it's going today.
Sure. So today is our 10th annual M Boutique, which is a project of the Chicago Metropolitan Board of the Chicago Urban League. And it's a program where we provide free prom dresses, shoes, accessories, and much more to any of the students who come to our event today.
And so how many students are you expecting?
We're expecting between 150 and 180 today. And right now we are serving probably, we're on number 80 right now. So we're working right through the crowd that's been here since 7 a.m. this morning, waiting to get inside to get as much as they possibly could for prom.
And all this is happening at Elliot Donnelly Youth Center. That's at 3947 South Michigan. And so you have prom dresses, you have accessories, you have, you know, hair stylists, you have a lot going on there to help make prom a special night for low-income students. Is all this donation-based, or were there from individuals, or was it donations from companies and designers as well?
It's from everyone. So we have had sponsors who are from corporate. We've had the Centene Corporation, R4 Services, even the Salvation Army. And we've had a dozen of small businesses who have given us anything from prom packages for transportation to makeup styling and things of that nature. And individuals have poured in donations of dresses and shoes and pretty much anything we've put out a call for. We're always amazed by the response of the Chicagoland area to this particular project.
And if someone wants to support the project, I know it's going on right now, so you probably don't want people showing up with a bunch of prom dresses, but how could people support the event at this point?
Sure. So if they could go to www.mboutique, and that's M, the word boutique, 2017.eventbrite.com, or they can send us an email at mboutique1983@gmail.com. Either way is a great way to get connected with us, and we look for support year-round, so we'd be happy to have anyone.
All right, so everybody, clean out your closets, do those things, and help support this great project that is part of Metropolitan Board of the Chicago Urban League, which is a chapter of the National Urban League of Young Professionals. Kiana McKenzie, I won't keep you because I know that you've got lots to do with this event, but I will tweet out links to both the Eventbrite page that you mentioned and as well as that Gmail so that people can help year-round. And thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll let you get back to all the things at M Boutique.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. All right. We are going to take a little break here, and then when we come back, we are going to be talking with the tech reporter from Washington Post about the FCC's new battle against the 2.4 billion, with a B, billion robocalls. It's become the number one consumer complaint. So we're going to be talking about that and how there's new stuff afoot. So we're going to take a look at that and break it. He's going to break it all down for us. So back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth with you till 1 o'clock. Talking about all the things here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and sharing part of your Saturday with me. It is kind of yucky out there, so I hope you're warm and dry wherever it is you are listening. But again, I appreciate your ears today. So still lots to do on the program. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about a couple different development projects here in Chicago, in particular, the Finkel site. And we're going to be talking about advertisers who are leaving YouTube after realizing their ads are coming before videos like, you know, hate speech and, you know, yucky stuff like that, that we would rather not be out there. But nonetheless, their ads are there and they're not having it. So they're bailing out on YouTube. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the program. But right now, we welcome back to the program. We've had him on before, the tech reporter at Washington Post, Brian Fung, because there are some developments I want to talk about with the FCC. They've proposed new rules that would allow phone companies to target and block robocalls because, you know, these robocallers are pretty smart. They figured out ways around it. So, like, you won't necessarily know the number you're picking up or things like that. So there's, you know, we always have to keep rules and regulations updated with technology. We have to keep those two things constantly updating to keep up with each other. So welcome to the program, Brian. Thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the new rules exactly as proposed, and how quickly could we see them taking effect?
So as you said, they're proposed rules, and what they do is propose to give internet you know, cellular carriers and phone companies a little bit greater flexibility to target and block phone calls from auto dialers that are trying to, you know, essentially put out spam calls. You know, statistics show that roughly 1 in 10 Americans have been affected by, you know, some sort of phone spam or scamming in the United States. And, you know, so this is a big problem that the FCC is trying to grapple with here. The rules that, you know, were proposed this week could go into effect later this year, you know, after a thorough period of public comment and, you know, public feedback. So we'll see what happens there.
You know, what I found was very interesting, many things interesting about the piece that you have at Washington Post. Everybody head to WashingtonPost.com to find this piece on this topic. But I didn't realize that's the number one consumer complaint every month is all around robocalls. I mean, I figure there's so many things to complain about. There wouldn't be a clear, you know, clear and above winner. But nonetheless, I think that's interesting that it is that pervasive, because we think about being on a do not call list as just kind of taking care of all of it. But in fact, that's not how it is. These robo dialers are getting around that quite easily.
Right. Well, you know, the do not call list is only effective up to a point. You know, because you're essentially specifying that, you know, you don't want your number to be dialed from, you know, certain set of telemarketers and whatnot. But in reality, a lot of folks have realized, you know, who are putting out these robocalls, that they can simply spoof their number, you know, essentially making it look like their number, that their call is coming from either an unregistered number or an invalid number, or a number that, you know, hasn't been assigned to a particular phone subscriber yet. So, you know, what the rules propose to do is to give phone companies the ability to look at, you know, essentially match these reported calls against the master list of phone numbers that haven't been assigned yet. And if that, you know, they find that the number does appear, or the call does appear to be coming from an unregistered number, they can take steps to block that call.
And this has gone beyond just consumers, because this has touched several, but two in particular that you note in the story, involvement from PayPal and AT&T that have both played an interesting role in this narrative around all of this.
Yeah, so what's interesting to understand here is that some companies do use robocalls for legitimate purposes. So, for instance, a bank may call you to notify you about unauthorized changes to your account, for instance, or you know, similar changes to your account. You know, when PayPal made a change to its policies, essentially, you know, requiring anyone who wanted to use PayPal to agree to accept robocalls, that created a big firestorm. And, you know, eventually, after a bunch of letters from Congress and, you know, consumer complaints, PayPal wound up backing down on those changes and reverted to a policy where, you know, you have to opt in to receive robocalls. But all of that has essentially added to this kind of public scrutiny of robocalls in generally, and has sort of contributed to this environment where now it seems like the regulators have been able to use that pressure to create new regulations or new rules governing that practice.
Certainly. And so how, as you're considering the scope of this and what all this would touch, what would that do? We've just come through an election, of course, but for future elections, I feel like that robocall, you have phone banking, but then you also have that robocall that comes in right before an election. How would that change that?
Well, actually, under the rules, political robocalling is not prohibited. So the government is able to dial you, and so this is basically aimed at targeting what are called illegal robocalls, those that consumers didn't sign up for or didn't consent to receive, and are sort of connected to financial scams and that kind of thing.
Very, very interesting. It's complex, but this is another one of those examples. I feel like we talk about this a lot on the show, of times where, policy and technology just have to catch up to each other. Often we see technology jumping out ahead, or user behavior around technology jumping out ahead, and people getting out in front of the law or doing things not quite where the law hasn't caught up to it yet. And I feel like this is yet another example. So AT&T played a role here too, because they helped form an industry group to kind of think through some of this.
That's right. They formed what they called a robocalling strike force, which was essentially just a group of companies that was helped, the government helped convene this. It was a project that was kind of sponsored by the former SEC chairman, Tom Wheeler, to try and address this problem. And so the strike group that AT&T was a part of came up with a number of recommendations for the SEC to take as far as new policy proposals, and some of them are making it into the SEC's current proposal that we saw this week.
Well, so next up, though, we have, as this is going through, as this is passing, the Senate has voted on it, I think, 3 or 4 days ago. Next, it's going to the House. But there is an opportunity for consumers to submit feedback. How do they do that exactly?
Okay, yeah. So I think, this is a slightly separate issue from the robocalling issue, but the Senate just voted to repeal a number of regulations that have to do with internet providers and how they deal with your consumer data as you surf the web and from your PC or your phone or your tablet. If the House also votes to repeal these rules, then it would mean that internet providers would not have to seek your permission before selling your data to third-party marketers or sharing that data internally. For example, Verizon bought AOL and Yahoo, then any data that Verizon's wireless subscribers generated as they used their mobile data, that information could be used to inform targeted advertising and stuff on AOL's properties or on Yahoo's properties, for example.
Oh, because why would it be problematic if anyone could see your browser history? I can't imagine that being a problem at all.
Right. Well, a lot of consumer advocates say this is sort of the beginning of a new era, I guess, for internet providers who, historically they've just been providers of internet access, but increasingly they want to become much more like Google and Facebook, mm-hmm. Becoming large advertisers in their own right. Using that data to sort of make more money and potentially plowing that money into their networks, although critics say that money would essentially go toward padding the bottom line.
Right, right. As ever, of course, right? Well, thank you so much, Brian Fung, for being with us, tech reporter at Washington Post. We will continue to turn to you for this as it develops and continues to roll on, and many, many other stories. Thanks for being with us and have a great Saturday.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We are going to take a little break and then get you to news here in just a bit. But we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Always grateful to you for that. I hope that you are warm and dry wherever you are listening to us. And again, thank you for tuning in today. So still lots to do on the show, lots of things to talk about. You know, when we look around the city, we have these big projects all around town, these major redevelopment sites. We think of the post office. We think of the Clybourne Corridor. We think of the Finkel site, all of those things. And so here to help us with understand the latest on all of them, we are joined by Ryan Ory, real estate reporter at Chicago Tribune. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back to the program. How are you today?
Doing great.
Well, thank you for joining us. So catch us up. What is the latest on all of these big, big projects that we think of all around the site, these redevelopment sites?
A couple that you mentioned have kind of been moving forward. Recently, the post office that you mentioned, has been in limbo for many, many years. And now a developer has bought the property and has started doing a lot of work to the interior of the building and readying it for what it hopes will be some leases with office tenants to help fill more than 2 million square feet of space in that building that's been vacant for decades.
Do we know? Do we know who any of those tenants are at this point?
Not right now. I mean, I don't think they have any deals lined up or necessarily imminent, but they are actively in the market talking to potential tenants, which is, the first time that project has reached the point where there's actually work going on inside the building. There's a lot of, stuff that needs to be repaired inside of there after it's sat vacant for so long. So it's the first time it's sort of actively like a player for tenants, since it's been out there just sitting, it's been sitting there, not really active in the market. So it's actually, the first time that they're legitimately talking with tenants that could go there. And that would be huge for the city after just watching that sit there and,
yeah, it's just
antagonize the city and the mayor and everyone else. So that's an encouraging sign, and I think they will eventually have success with it. It's just a matter of how long that takes, and it's a huge project.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that you mentioned is the former Finkel Steel site that's now been demolished, and it's a huge a huge plot of land right plopped in the middle of some of the most populated neighborhoods on the north side, and that is as I just wrote, that one is looking like it's going to move forward because the city is making some moves to change some long-standing zoning that would as it is now prevent a lot of potential uses from going to that site, particularly residential and a lot of types of retail, and so as the city moves to do that, I think that That's a huge step for the developer of that project, Sterling Bay, which is now assembled about 40 acres of land, which is pretty much unheard of to be able to have 40 acres of open land sitting there in Lincoln Park and next to Bucktown. And so that's a big one.
Right. And so for those who may not know exactly the boundaries of that plot of land, where exactly does it begin and end?
They bought the actual Sterling Bay owns what had been the actual steel plant site, and then has also bought several properties adjacent to it as well. But it's roughly where the Cortland Avenue Bridge goes over the river. It's on the east side of the river going, several blocks north and south of Cortland. And then Sterling Bay has also bought some land across the other side of the river on the west side of the river. And I wouldn't be surprised if they continue to buy some other properties nearby. So already, as I mentioned in the column I just wrote, it's already almost twice the size of Millennium Park, the site. And if they continue to add more land, it would be just expanding in the scope of what could be done there.
Right. I mean, that's significant when you put it in perspective that like that, that saying it's almost twice as much land as Millennium Park. Suddenly we kind of get a sense of just how large that area is. So tell us more about this rezoning, because that's very significant, not only for the type of business that will be attracted, but that residential component is so big.
Yeah. So the Finkel site and some other nearby land, as well as some other sites in the city that kind of long been considered potentially prime real estate, sit in what are called planned manufacturing districts. And those were first created in the 80s by the city as a way to protect long-standing manufacturing businesses from encroachment by, residents and retail and other things that don't want, loud, potentially stinky neighbors, and they were there first. And so the city at that time was looking to protect businesses from, and just allow them to continue operating how they had been for many years. And now the city has taken another look at it because a lot of those areas have really changed dramatically. They've gentrified a lot. The Finkel site, as I mentioned, is, surrounded by multi-million dollar homes in Lincoln Park and just across the other side in Bucktown and several other neighborhoods that are very desirable as residential neighborhoods now. And so the city is taking a look at or has proposed eliminating some of these PMD designations and, freeing them up to take new proposals to the city for zoning approval. And that's a big step because to this point, there are 15 PMDs. None have ever had the zoning stripped. And those are very restrictive. They don't allow residential. They don't allow a lot of other types of things. They do allow some office use and some other things, but that's, if you're going to develop 40 acres or more, and have a mix of a whole bunch of uses, you're probably going to look to do some residential on the site. And
sure.
So if those changes happen, it sounds like the city's moving toward making that happen. It will be interesting to see what then follows. The zoning changes would be for this entire corridor of about 4 miles along the river along both sides of the river and a few blocks in each direction, east, west, going through a lot of neighborhoods that are, that are very populated on either side of this industry. As I mentioned, Lincoln Park stretching up all the way almost to Lakeview, stretching down almost to downtown. And so they're looking at changing a lot of these types of zoning, trying to create a new system of trails and recreational areas along the river, new parks, new transportation routes. I mean, there's a very ambitious project, and it could take many years for all this to happen. But I think if this zoning this change goes into effect, some of these things will start happening pretty quickly, like the Finkel plan emerging.
Right. So timeline-wise, when do you think we will see, start to see, and what milestones specifically should we be looking for that would impact the public here as we're looking at the Finkel site?
Changes that are proposed would set the guidelines for what the city would listen to for potential developments, but it would still require any individual project to go through the same process as always of getting approval from the city, talking with neighborhood groups, talking with aldermen, talking with city zoning officials, and getting their project approved. So even if this goes into effect in the next few months, as the city hopes it will, you're still looking at a series of, for something as large as Finkel and as many people as already there are already living and working near there, they're going to hear a lot of people's opinions, and they're going to hear probably complaints about many aspects of what they initially proposed, because that is in a very high traffic area already, very dense area already. And so it's not like this new zoning is going to go into effect and there's going to be trains on the site, you know, a couple days later. It's still going to be that or any other of these big projects that are likely to happen in that corridor. This gets them, I guess, to the – this will help get them to the starting line, but it's not going to it's not going to mean a wave of, you know,
it won't be overnight.
See a bunch of, you won't see a bunch of workers just showing up on these sites the next day.
Yeah.
So it's still going to be a long road ahead for some of these projects, but it's a major step forward for some of these sites that have kind of been languishing, are no longer really areas where manufacturing is probably going to come in and set up a giant, you know, factory operation. And they've kind of just been in this limbo of what next. And so this will start things moving forward, and it'll be yet to be seen how quickly that means these projects get off the ground.
Yeah, indeed. Well, anytime we see all those different stakeholders, especially where zoning is involved, you know, when we see, you know, new developments, when we see residential coming in, when we see likely, you know, exodus from manufacturing, when we see things like that, it's never fast, is it? Well, thank you so much for being with us, Ryan Ory, real estate reporter for Chicago Tribune. We will continue to check back with you as these, as this and other projects come together. Thanks so much. Thanks for being
with us.
All right. We are going to take a little break, and then we are going to talk all about YouTube ads, in particular how some advertisers are like, yeah, no, I don't want to be on that ad. And so they're pulling their ad dollars from YouTube and what YouTube is doing about that. More on that when we come back on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Right as I said that, some people were walking by the studio and they turned in and looked at me like I scared them. So maybe not dulcet tones of Amy Guth after all. I think I just scared some tourists. Ah, goodness. Well, that happens. Well, here in a bit, we are going to be talking about how YouTube advertisers are shifting gears a little bit as they don't have a lot of control over what videos their ads appear on. So, you know, they're kind of shifting and doing things like that. So we are joined now by Sapna Maheshwari, who wrote about advertisers who are leaving YouTube, this very, very thing. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Well, so tell us about this, because we've all seen this, you know, these ads that pop up on YouTube videos, and sometimes mm-hmm. you wonder about perhaps some disharmony between the ad message and the video, particularly, you know, where you see a large brand or a brand that you know stands for a particular thing on a video that doesn't seem like it really lines up. So break all this down for us, if you would.
Yeah, so we've definitely all, I think, seen this before. Basically, this became a huge controversy earlier this month when the Times of London went out and started looking for the worst examples of this. And it wasn't that hard to find. They found things like the Guardian newspaper, which is a very left-leaning paper, on extremist videos. I mean, they found AT&T on, I think, and Verizon on an ISIS video. It was all kinds of just the worst stuff for any brand or any advertiser to show up on, and clearly showed some gaps in what YouTube's filters were catching. And so they took a bunch of screenshots and went to these brands, and it started this advertiser exodus. And so that's actually continued after this happened. The Wall Street Journal just on Friday found really big brands on extremely offensive videos that were blatantly racist. I mean, they had racial slurs in the titles of the videos. And that led to another wave of brands pulling their marketing, including Coca-Cola and Walmart.
Well, and so when we look at programmatic advertising, which is the what we call this type of ad that's not a human being necessarily putting it on a piece of content. This comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. This came up a lot during the election and immediately after, as Twitter users started tweeting screen grabs saying like, hey, so-and-so brand, do you know you have an ad on Breitbart? Things like that attached to certain stories. And so do you feel like having researched this as extensively as you have in your piece for the New York Times, do you feel like we are entering a spot where programmatic is going to have to adapt and change in order just to stay out of peril like this?
I think so. I mean, I think every marketer out there is asking themselves this question, because really this has all been about kind of targeting a person, as you know, rather than where they appear. And this type of advertising has decimated a lot of top publishers, as we've all seen, who are facing job cuts and all of that. And so I think, you know, brands are asking, like, what is the value of putting my money through all these machines and going all across the internet? You know, should we be making a list of maybe 1,000 websites that we're okay with appearing on? Should we be asking more questions of who gets our money? And I think the hard thing is, in the past, brands have been like, well, you know, this is one bad appearance of millions of ads I serve every day. But as you mentioned, with these Twitter accounts and the attention from news outlets, all of a sudden that one, you know, unfortunate or embarrassing appearance can suddenly become a viral story in its own right. And so I think that's a huge wake-up call for advertisers, because the average person doesn't understand that, or maybe even care that an automated machine placed the ad. They're just seeing the ad.
Right, right. And I see this a lot too around even the kind of the retargeting aspect of programmatic ads, mm-hmm. where, you know, you go and you search a particular shoe or something and then it shows up on a bunch of sites. That's because you searched it. But mm-hmm. I always see people tweeting screen grabs and saying, you know, oh, Big Brother, and, you know, getting really concerned about data, mm-hmm. which is a valid concern. But I think there's a lot of mystery, and programmatic ads are pretty complex. And so there's a lot to them. But as you note, it to have them so... I don't know, that's the word I want, mispaired, right, with content, serves mm-hmm. serves no one, right? It's not a good use of ad dollars. It's certainly not in the right, at the right user. So it really serves no one. Mm-hmm. So it does seem like there's a bit of a revolution coming with programmatic advertising, which was so groundbreaking just a couple of years ago. It seemed like this savior to a lot of media companies, and that seemed quite excited about this way to generate a lot of mm-hmm. ad revenue. So what do you think that next step will be? What is that revolution of automatic advertising going to look like, do you think?
Well, I do think we're actually starting to see some really prominent marketers start to consider the idea of whitelisting, which is what you call it when basically you restrict your programmatic ads from running only on 1,000 sites. And brands have been really scared of this in the past because they don't want to miss out on sort of the whole internet, basically, which is the promise of programmatic. But there's a lot of questions being raised on what is the value of an impression? You know, where are these ads showing up? It's gotten much easier to game the system. So, I mean, I think it's hard to say what it'll look like, but clearly the attention from Breitbart and fake news has escalated now into this conversation of, you know, Coca-Cola showing up on a super racist video on YouTube.
Right.
And so I think, I mean, changes have got to occur when you have the world's biggest marketers suddenly going head to head with Google.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I mean, this is that same conversation when we start thinking about the value of an impression. I feel like it's one we had about the value of a page view, the value of a Twitter follower or a Facebook fan. And it's just kind of the latest piece of that. Well, it's all very, very interesting. So everybody head to NewYorkTimes.com and read this story. It's about YouTube advertiser exodus and how it's highlighted the perils of online ads. Safna Maheshwari, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we are going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN.